This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Russia blasted an apartment block in Ukraine with missiles on Wednesday and swarmed cities with drone attacks overnight. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
A display of force as President Vladimir Putin bid farewell to his visiting dear friend and Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. Security camera footage captured the moment a Russian missile slammed into the side of an apartment building in the Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia. Flames explode from the blast, followed by plumes of smoke as pedestrians flee in terror. The bombardment came as Xi wrapped up his visit to Moscow. Hosting Xi this week was Putin's grandest diplomatic gesture since he launched the war a year ago and became a pariah in the West. The two men referred to each other as dear friend, promised economic cooperation, condemned the West, and described relations as the best they have ever been.
That was Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the Eastern Front Line on Wednesday, meeting with troops and giving awards to servicemen. Zelensky said in an evening video address that it was a personal honor to support the men and women defending Ukraine in the toughest frontline conditions. He added that it is painful to look at the cities in the Donetsk region to which Russia has brought such terrible suffering. Ukrainian forces have held out for about 8 months in Bakhmut, despite taking heavy casualties in one of the bloodiest battles since Russia's full-scale invasion 13 months ago. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Wednesday urged all members of the International Criminal Court to comply with an arrest warrant that the court issued for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Last week, the court accused Putin of the war crime of illegally deporting hundreds of children from Ukraine. The legal move will obligate the court's 123 member states to arrest Putin and transfer him to The Hague for trial if he sets foot on their territory. The United States is not a party to the ICC. This is VOA News. Amnesty International says Uganda's new anti-homosexuality bill amounts to a grave assault on LGBTQ people. The bill passed Uganda's parliament late Tuesday with only one dissenting voice. Helena Athumani reports from Kampala.
After 6 hours of debate, the bill was finally passed, with legislators singing the national anthem in celebration. Parliament now awaits President Yoweri Museveni's veto or signature before it is thrown out or passed into law. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, called on Museveni Wednesday not to sign the bill, which he described as among the worst of its kind in the world and a deeply troubling development. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
A United Nations report says more than a quarter of the world's population do not have access to safe drinking water. AP correspondent Donna Warder has more.
Near Abidjan, Ivory Coast, women and children stand in a river, pouring water into buckets that they carry home on their heads. A new United Nations report says 26% of the world's population doesn't have access to safe drinking water, and 46% lack access to basic sanitation. Richard Connor, the editor-in-chief of the report, says the estimated cost of ensuring that all people have access to clean water and sanitation by 2030 will cost between $600 billion and $1 trillion a year. I'm Donna Warder.
New York City prosecutors postponed a scheduled grand jury session Wednesday in the investigation into former U.S. President Donald Trump and told them to be on standby for Thursday. AP correspondent Julie Walker has that story.
The grand jury postponement is according to four people familiar with the matter, and it slows a decision whether to charge Donald Trump. The Manhattan DA is investigating hush money payments to Stormy Daniels during his 2016 presidential campaign. It's not the payments, but the accounting that could bring an indictment from the grand jury, which does not need a unanimous vote. While the proceedings are supposed to be secret, Trump has been railing against the investigation and claiming his arrest is imminent. Law enforcement officials have accelerated security preparations in the event of unrest. Julie Walker, New York.
The small animals known as badgers have dug out a home underneath a major rail line in the Netherlands, leaving tens of thousands of passengers facing delays. Train traffic has been halted, possibly for weeks, between two major southern cities due to worries that the badgers' tunnels have weakened the ground under the tracks. But the company that maintains the country's rail network says the badgers are protected by law and must be removed before repairs can begin. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Thursday, March 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. commits billions of dollars towards the global water crisis as the U.N. opens an international water conference.
This is a crisis and one that demands concrete action. That's why I am proud to announce that the United States is committing $49 billion.
A Turkish official warns that shoddy construction in Europe's largest city could lead to a potential earthquake disaster.
Istanbul is Europe's most populous city, home to more than 15 million people, and is prone to quakes. Its mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, warns the city faces an unprecedented threat.
And Russia blasts an apartment block in Ukraine and swarms cities with drone attacks. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russia blasted an apartment block in Ukraine with missiles on Wednesday and swarmed its cities with drone attacks overnight in a display of force as President Vladimir Putin bid farewell to his visiting Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. Zachary Goldman of Reuters reports.
Security camera footage captured the moment a Russian missile slammed into the side of an apartment building in the Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia. Flames explode from the blast, followed by plumes of smoke as pedestrians flee in terror. Reuters journalists filmed the aftermath of the shattered building. Resident Ivan Nalivaiko said, "When I got out, there was destruction, smoke, people screaming, debris. Then the firefighters and rescuers came." 81-year-old Alexandra Pavlova said she was lucky she made it to the hallway after the blast destroyed her home. Sitting in an ambulance, she said, "I have nowhere to sleep." A local official said the strike left one dead and 33 injured, including three children. And at a hospital outside Kyiv, a teacher is treated for burns from a Russian strike on a dormitory. The bombardment came as Xi wrapped up his visit to Moscow. Hosting Xi this week was Putin's grandest diplomatic gesture since he launched the war a year ago and became a pariah in the West. The two men referred to each other as dear friend, promised economic cooperation, condemned the West, and described relations as the best they have ever been. Xi departed, telling Putin, quote, "Now there are changes that haven't happened in 100 years. When we are together, we drive these changes." Washington criticized the timing of the trip just days after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Putin on war crimes charges. In Washington Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told a Senate committee that the world was watching this war to see whether or not Russia's aggression would win the day or go down in defeat.
The stakes in Ukraine go well beyond Ukraine. I think if China is looking at this, and they are looking at it very carefully, they will draw lessons for how the world comes together or doesn't to stand up to this aggression.
Despite the bloodiest fighting of the war, which both Ukraine and Russia describe as a meat grinder, the front line has barely moved for 4 months.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters, and the United Nations opened its first conference on water security in almost half a century on Wednesday with a plea to governments to better manage one of humanity's shared resources. The UN says a quarter of the world's population relies on unsafe drinking water, while half lacks basic sanitation. Ensuring access to clean drinking water and sanitation is part of the 17-point to-do list the UN has set for sustainable development, alongside ending hunger and poverty, achieving gender equality, and taking action on climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Water is humanity's lifeblood. From the food we eat to the ecosystems and biodiversity that enrich our world, to the prosperity that sustains nations, to the economic engines of agriculture, manufacturing, and energy generation, to our health, hygiene, and survival itself. Water is a human right and the common development denominator to shape a better future. But water is in deep trouble. We are draining humanity's lifeblood through vampiric overconsumption and unsustainable use, and evaporating it through global heating. We've broken the water cycle, destroyed ecosystems, and contaminated groundwater. Nearly 3 out of 4 natural disasters are linked to water. 1 in 4 people lives without safely managed water services or clean drinking water. and over 1.7 billion people lack basic sanitation. Excellencies, dear friends, this is more than a conference on water. It is a conference on today's world, seen from the perspective of its most important resource. This conference must represent a quantum leap in the capacity of member states and the international community to recognize and act upon the vital importance of water to our world's sustainability and as a tool to foster peace and international cooperation. From water as a key driver across economies and policy making, to the recognition of water and sanitation as a human right, from the integration of water and climate policies to an innovative approach in the use of water in food production, now is the moment for game-changing commitments to bring the Water Action Agenda to life.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. And to tackle worsening global water crisis, Washington announced a $49 billion fund towards equitable, climate-resilient water and sanitation investments at home and around the world. U.S. UN Representative Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
A 2022 study by the University of California, Los Angeles, estimated that almost half of the world's population will suffer severe water stress by 2030. This is a crisis, one that affects people around the globe and one that demands concrete action. That's why I am proud to announce that the United States is committing $49 billion toward equitable, climate-resilient water and sanitation investments at home and around the globe. That significant number should demonstrate just how seriously we take water security. These investments will help to create jobs, prevent conflict, safeguard public health, reduce the risk of famine and hunger, and enable us to respond to climate change and natural disasters. This announcement builds on the first ever White House Action Plan on Global Water Security, an innovative and unified approach that brings together U.S. diplomatic and development tools, as well as science and technology, to respond to water security around the world. But let's be clear. The global crisis requires global cooperation. The Security Council must take up the issue of water scarcity, especially because we know that water scarcity exacerbates conflict and disrupts peace and security.
That's U.S. UN Representative Linda Thomas-Greenfield. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says governments must do more to move away from fossil fuels. The Biden administration has taken several steps to do so, but a recent decision to approve an oil drilling project in Alaska has disappointed those who want the U.S. to swiftly cut greenhouse gas emissions. VOA's Veronica Barderas-Iglesias explains.
After a failed attempt during the Trump administration, crude oil producer ConocoPhillips now has a green light from the Biden administration to build and operate a scaled-back version of its Willow oil drilling project in Alaska. Environmentalists are fighting back. Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon spoke with VOA via Skype.
We're suing the federal government because it has a responsibility under our National Environmental Policy Act to analyze alternatives to mitigate environmental harm. ConocoPhillips will still be able to develop 92% of the oil that they contemplated in their original proposal.
Bridget Pisarianos is with Trustees for Alaska.
Air quality, water quality, how the project would impact animals. A number of people in the community have real concerns about climate change.
But Alaskan peoples on the North Slope are not a monolith. Nagarek Harcharek, president of the Voice of the Arctic in Upiat, lobbied in favor of the Willow project.
There's going to be 2,500 construction jobs on the site itself. The research into our subsistence resources, so the whales and the terrestrial animals that we have, and all of that is funded through the taxes generated from the resource development.
ConocoPhillips and several U.S. agencies declined to be interviewed, but White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre defended the administration's decision.
Some of the company's leases are decades old, granted by prior administrations. The company has a legal right to those leases.
After the Department of the Interior green-lighted the Willow project, President Joe Biden announced new actions to conserve and restore federal lands and water habitats across the nation. While he did not keep his promise to reject new drilling on public lands, Biden's environmental record is strong, said Tiernan Sittenfeld with the League of Conservation Voters.
The Inflation Reduction Act is the single biggest investment our country has ever made. It's $369 billion in climate solutions, in clean energy, in environmental justice.
The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change urged again this week that nations phase out fossil fuels. A quick shift by the U.S. is unlikely, according to political scientist Stefan Schmidt.
It's not so easy to be environmental when you have, you know, so few options substituting the existing energy, means of transportation and production of electricity, which relies on hydrocarbons largely.
Congressional pushback adds to the challenges. House Republicans are expected to vote on a bill next week that would, among other things, end a federal moratorium on the leasing of federal land for coal mining. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
In other news, Yemeni security officials say at least 16 people have been killed in renewed fighting in the strategic province of Marib. The new violence comes days after diplomats and leaders expressed new hope for peace efforts in the war-torn country and on the eve of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. The officials say fighting began Tuesday evening after Houthi rebels moved on the city of Harib in the south of the province of Marib. They said the fighting continued through Wednesday and led to communications being cut in the city and its surroundings. Yemen's devastating conflict began in 2014 when Houthis seized the capital of Sana'a and much of northern Yemen and forced the government into exile. The removal of millions of rotten fish is finally underway Wednesday in southeastern Australia, almost a week after an unprecedented mass die-off. Scientists believe the fish kill in Manidee, 1,000 kilometers west of Sydney, was caused by floods and a heat wave. A senior police officer in charge of the cleanup has said up to 20 million fish may have died. Phil Mercer reports.
Residents in Menindee say the town is facing a funeral procession of millions of fish carcasses. They've been told by the authorities that the quality of the outback town's water supply won't be affected. Parts of the Darling River in the far west of New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, have been clogged with dead fish since last weekend. Rotting carcasses stretch along several kilometres of the waterway. The clean-up is underway. Contractors will use two types of booms to sweep up the river to collect both fish on the surface and those already sinking. Scientists believe low oxygen levels in the river following a recent heat wave caused the massive die-off. Experts say the native fish suffocated in the hypoxic black water. It is a naturally occurring phenomenon that causes extremely low oxygen levels. Australian police say removing the dead fish will be a logistical nightmare. The emergency response is being coordinated by New South Wales Police Commander Brett Greentree. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Wednesday that these are difficult times for the outback town.
You know, the poor people of Menindee who have not only had to put up with the floods recently, they've had a really tough time, and now all these decomposing fish, it's been really tough for that community. As I said, I've got the local police commander there leading the operation from a local perspective, and yeah, it's tough on that community, so I really feel for them.
The town suffered another mass fish kill in 2018, which was caused by extreme drought. This time widespread flooding and excessive heat are to blame. Authorities will investigate the deaths and will try to find the underlying causes. Scientists say the impact of climate change is making extreme droughts, floods and heat waves more frequent in Australia. The Darling River is part of the Murray-Darling Basin, which is Australia's largest river system. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. And Istanbul, Europe's largest city, was spared the wrath of Turkey's February earthquakes, But its mayor warns bad building construction could mean a huge disaster is waiting to happen. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
February's earthquakes turned thousands of apartment buildings into piles of rubble. Many people blame shoddy construction. Istanbul is Europe's most populous city, home to more than 15 million people, and is prone to quakes. Its mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, warns the city faces an unprecedented threat. He said, "We don't know when the earthquake will hit. To let our people live in buildings that threaten their lives is, God forbid, to knowingly let them die." A municipal website allows residents to request their buildings be checked. This building is set to be demolished due to poor construction, while others are being strengthened, with the municipality offering grants and cheap loans to residents. But many people say they cannot afford to pay. They now fear for themselves and their families. Sabiha Kuşkun, an Istanbul resident, says she feels unsafe. She said, "My family's apartment building is a five-story building and quite old. My brother's family lives there. They are terrified, and their only consolation is they live on the top floor. And if the building collapses, they hope they can survive." Istanbul is the center of the country's decade-long construction boom. Observers say that, like developers in the quake-struck region, those in the city benefited from government zoning amnesties that allow them to pay a fine to legalize buildings that violated stringent earthquake regulations. Istanbul architect Ömer Yılmaz says that practice was a tragic mistake. He said the whole system in Turkey is built around the construction industry. Whatever we saw in the quake-hit cities of Hatay and Maraş, we will probably see the same here in Istanbul. So we're talking about a big risk. The zoning amnesty has caused a huge problem. It's one of the foundations of the wider problem. Many developers were arrested in the aftermath of the February quakes. But Turkey's construction boom has driven the country's unprecedented economic growth, underpinning Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his AKP party's years of electoral success, says analyst Atilla Yeşilada, Turkey analyst for Global Source Partners.
Laws and regulations notwithstanding, it's the unstated policy of this government to use every square inch of land, A, to build residential or commercial property expansion, B, to feed an ever-growing group of home builders and construction companies, which in turn finance AKP and Erdogan's election campaigns.
Dealing with the threat of unsafe buildings is now a priority, with Istanbul's mayor warning that 90,000 buildings will be at severe risk when the next earthquake strikes. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
This is Science in a Minute.
When looking for extrasolar planets that might have life, scientists often look for those that reside in habitable zones or areas of a solar system where conditions could be just right for life as we know it to survive. Scientists at the University of California at Irvine provide evidence in a new study that might open up the search for extraterrestrial life beyond habitable zone planets. Unlike the planets in our solar system, many exoplanets are tidally locked to their host star. In other words, they have a permanent day and night side. One side could have scorching hot temperatures, while the other side would always be extremely cold. The UC Irvine scientists propose that areas on these planets, which they call terminator zones, that are at the dividing line between its day and night sides, could also provide conditions to harbor life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Next up, in honor of Women's History Month, we focus on the brave women of Afghanistan and Iran as their respective regimes deprive them of basic human rights. We speak with Palwasha Kakar, Director for Religion and Inclusive Societies at the U.S. Institute of Peace, about how Afghan and Iranian women are fighting for rights to education, work, and personal dignity. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
How do you get international news? Radio, television, social media, or all of the above? Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp. Leave a message, comments, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code plus 1, then 202-258-3076.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news. Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week, for the 5-minute VOA newscast. We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the world. Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and issues in the news on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua from Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is an optimistic time for U.S.-India relations, declared U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo during the U.S.-India CEO Forum and the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity meetings. Our partnership with India is one of the most consequential relationships, and I'd say one of our most promising bilateral relationships, said Secretary Raimondo. The reason for that is we share a common set of values grounded around our democratic traditions, along with a commitment to promoting a free, open, rules-based order to bolster security and prosperity. There are opportunities for the U.S. and India to expand their economic relationship, creating jobs in both countries and establishing more resilient and secure supply chains, said Secretary Raimondo.
Just a few weeks ago, Boeing and Air India announced an order for 220 aircraft, which is a historic deal that reflects the strength of our economic relationship and will support a tremendous number of jobs in the United States.
Semiconductors are another great example of our shared priorities, declared Secretary Raimondo.
Both the United States and India are implementing semiconductor incentive programs, and we discussed how we could coordinate those investments, which is in both of our interests, and ensure the best possible outcome for both of our countries. We would like to see India achieve its aspirations to play a larger role in the electronic supply chain. And to that end, the MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, that I am signing on this trip around semiconductors is designed to help achieve that goal.
We are also delighted to be working with India as part of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or the IPEF, noted Secretary Raimondo.
Through the IPEF, the United States, India, and 12 other partners in this region are developing policies to create more resilient and secure supply chains, accelerate progress on our green transitions, and demonstrate our commitment to fostering a better business environment.
Bilaterally and along with partners across the region, there's a tremendous amount that the United States and India can do to benefit both their economies. The U.S., said Secretary Raimondo, remains very optimistic about the opportunities to expand and strengthen the U.S.-India relationship in the years to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.